Blog Talk Radio.
As the year comes to a close, we're in the Christmas season now. We're in the holidays. Just finished with the winter solstice, and it's getting cold, and it's a time to kind of gather and be with friends and family. But for this week, I wanted to kind of review the year. And there's no one better to speak with about 2017 events than Graham Hancock, the noted author of Fingerprints of the Gods, Magicians of the Gods, and a number of other topics. And we're going to speak with Graham today about what he's discovered. He's working on a new book about this asteroid hit and its effect on the North American region. I want to touch base with him on this debate that he had with Michael Shermer, the skeptic, the publisher of the Skeptic magazine, on Joe Rogan's podcast earlier in the year. And he brings a lot to light in our discussion today. So I think you're going to enjoy that. We'll hear from Ashley Cowley. Ashley is going to tell us a little bit about some discoveries he's made. These are all these unusual buildings that he continues to visit in Scotland. And we'll hear some information around the world in our news segment today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, December 23rd, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Days have come. It's Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you. Hope you're doing well. You know, I'm so glad that the solstice is over. I mean, I love hiking after work. I like hiking in the afternoon, early evening when the sun's up. And, you know, I've been wearing my headlamp and hiking in the dark. And I think I've discussed this a little bit, but I don't like hiking in the dark. But I got to get out. Got to get my air. And, you know, now lately the sun's going down at 5:30, but now that's changed. Now we can go back and I can get out and, you know, nothing's better than a hike at like 6 o'clock and then the light's still on or out till about 8:30. And, it's tough. It's tough hiking in the dark, but hey, I love it. Hey, you know, it's time to go out and get gifts. And I think if you haven't got your gift now, you know, it's important to get those taken care of. I got myself a few things this year. I sit a lot, and they have these very cool platform desks. They're desktops that rise and lower. When they first came out, they were really spendy. They were like $500 or $800. This is like 5-6 years ago, and they're basically a hydraulic platform that raises and lowers with a grip. You grab the grip and you lift it up or you drop it down depending on, you know, how you're sitting or whatever. I finally got one of these things. The one I got is by a company called Steady Stand. Actually, I'm standing right now as I'm speaking with you. And hey, this is a really good platform. It cost me about $200. It's really comfortable. It's one of those self-giving kinds of things that kind of improves your life. There's a lot of that kind of stuff out there. But this is an important addition because, you know, they say that sitting all day is really bad, not only for your back, just health-wise, because your organs are kind of crunched. And I'm spending half the day now standing. So, and it feels good. I feel a lot better. So that was one gift. The other gift is one of these new Goose Down jackets. Now, when Goose Down jackets first came out, they were huge. They were puffed out. It looks like you were wearing a balloon, a little rigid balloon. This new type of down jacket I got is this micro down in these very thin layers of down that surround the body. And these jackets are so well crafted now that they actually breathe really well. And I wear them inside. I keep them on after coming out. You know, I mean, here in Northern California, you know, we get some cold evenings. I think it's, you know, down to the 40s. Sometimes, about low 40s is uncomfortable for us. Those of you in the eastern United States and in Europe and countries that have really cold winter. I mean, I was in Paris last year around this time, and it was -5. And that's a whole different kind of outfit. But you can really use these Goose Down jackets for fairly cold environments. And I've found that at least here in Northern California, they're fairly comfortable. And so this is like my second jacket, thin Goose Down construction. And I'm loving it. Another gift for me. Yeah. So anyhow, hope you should give yourself a couple of gifts. You deserve it. Go out and get yourself a couple of gifts. So do something like that. You know, a really good gift to give yourself, and if you're in the mood, give one of these gifts to a friend, is the Gaia membership, Gaia.com. They have over 7,000 titles. 7,000 and growing. Each month they come out with two new titles. And these are amazing subjects. These are in-depth discussions on ancient Egypt, South America, China, Mexico, around the world. And I've been talking about this ancient civilization series that's hosted by Graham Hancock. It's excellent. It is excellent. And you can give it to a friend. You know, it's 99 cents. It's a cheap gift. And then after that, it's $9.95. You can just say, hey, here's the gift. You got to do, you know, become a member. Or, you know, they can bail after the first month. But it's an amazing gift. The production quality of all these presentations is very, very high quality. And super gift. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients and check us out. I mean, it's a really, really great gift, and give it to yourself. Give it to yourself. Check it out for a month. If you don't like it, you know, I'm really sure you're going to like it, but hang in there for at least a month. Check out all these topics I've been discussing. If you're into ancient aliens, there's a whole Van Duyken series where he's talking about his new book, The Gods Never Left Us. He also goes into detail about new discoveries that he's made, how current science is validating his research, and a whole bunch of other topics that are just fantastic. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to to you live from around the world. It's Earth Ancient News.
Hey, you know, we talk a lot about megalithic buildings, huge stones. We don't know how some of these buildings were built, some of the stoneworks in the 50 to 100-ton range. I mean, the Great Pyramid at Cheops has interior stones that are 50, some weigh a couple hundred. There's even stonework that's over 100 tons. How these were built, we don't know. But hey, there's a new series of buildings that have been discovered. Actually, they've been known about for quite a while. In Sicily, Italy, there is the Valley of the Temple, and there is these giant human sculptures in the Temple of Zeus. And these are 30-plus feet tall, and they're created out of solid stone. They're created in stone sections. And these are giant figures that are holding up the roof, and the building was destroyed through natural calamity or just through age. And they've found a number of these gigantic figures on the ground. There's one that I show on the Facebook page that they've reconstructed. And these things are enormous. Now, there's a lot of curiosity about this figures. And some people believe that the Greeks inherited this building, and these figures are actually much, much older. I don't know about that. There's not a lot of information about these figures because they just don't know how old they are. The building's dated to 380 BC, but there's a great opportunity to consider earlier dates on that. So that's all on the Facebook page, as is all of our news. Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to the group page. Or if you don't like Facebook, go to the earthancients.com, and these automatically will be posted there. Our friend Hugh Newman, based in London, has posted a new video on the odd stone spheres that are found in Scotland. These are between 5 and 8,000-year-old stone spheres that are carved in granite, and they're carved in a number of different geometric shapes and designs. Some people believe that they were used in war to be hurled at people. Others think they're toys, but these are extremely advanced designs, which is also part of an article series. There's a two-part article series that's in Ancient Origins magazine. You should check it out. American spy satellites are revealing that there are thousands of forgotten ancient sites in Afghanistan. And this is interesting to me because I thought we were able to get in there and see some of these sites, but these satellites are picking up apparently huge ruined cities that are in war areas, war zones. They have been releasing these photographs to the scientific community just to give them a heads up. And some of these ruins are monstrous. Some of these buildings have huge walls, very well-conceived rooms, structural designs that are very sophisticated. We're just, you know, it's kind of a problem simply because a lot of these places are destroyed. Now, we've seen ISIS actually get into various ancient ruins in Iraq, destroy not only the sculptures, but destroy buildings and things like that. So let's hope we can save some of these cities that are found in parts of Afghanistan. So you can see all of this and more on the Earth Ancients Facebook page. Go to the news area, and we have galleries, we have articles, and we have a great information there that's posted each day. So now we're going to head down to Colombia, South America. We want to check in with Ashley Cowie. Ashley is the host of the People's History Channel, and we want to hear what he's up to this week. So Here's Ash. So it's time to check in with Ashley Cowie. Ashley is down in Colombia, South America, and he is the host of the People's History Show, which airs in the UK. Ash, how you doing, man?
Top of the world. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, I wanted to compliment you, and I want to talk a little bit about this new program, this new video that you put up when you were in Scotland. It's called The Secrets of the Atlantic Brooch, and I think I said it wrong, didn't I? Is it Brox or Brooch?
It's, you know what? It's potluck. It's a Scottish word that generally only Scottish people can say. It sounds like this. It goes, a broch, a broch. But I don't think you're going to be able to get that sound.
Okay. Hey, well, listen, you are in this video with Ian McLean, and he is an expert or a research investigator on these superstructures, these unusual stone buildings that are all over different parts of the Scottish landscape. Tell us a little bit about this.
Right, so the video, it's a half-hour feature. It's a documentary. I was in Scotland 3 months ago. I teamed up with Ian McLean, who is like this history hero in the far north of Scotland, who every week goes and visits these superstructures, as you called them. These are Iron Age circular homes, grain storage units at the centres of communities built about 2,500 years ago in Scotland. So we went and investigated them and performed an experiment. Our theory was, the historical theory is that you can see one broch from another. So they possibly together form some kind of long-distance communication system. So we set up sighting poles and we back-sighted from one broch to the other. And indeed, we proved that for 4 miles up a bendy, winding river strath, you could see one broch from another. So it's like an early warning alarm system. If a boat appears on the horizon, flag can be raised and a message sent inland 4 miles within minutes.
You know, I mean, it was really impressive about how they laid out these different buildings and the foundations and so on. But what is the dating? When we look at these, is this Iron Age? When we say Iron Age, is that 20,000 years ago, 30,000? How long ago?
So those were built about 500 BC, about 2,500 years ago, by a culture that had been in cave nests since around 6,000 BC. They were known as the Groovedware people. They came through the Neolithic and became the broch builders of the late Iron Age. And those buildings were, you know, people lived in those until about 400 AD, and then they were greatly abandoned. And the stones from these brochs were used to rebuild cottages and farm settlements over the last century.
Some of these brochs are very well engineered. Where did these people come up with this design? Are you... show a portion of the video of these buildings and how they were constructed. Just very sophisticated.
The sophistication is invisible. Here's the thing, Cliff. The stonework itself is on another level, and Ian explains it out perfectly. But it's what you can't see is where the magic is. Not only were these living environments, but the walls are double-layered, so there's a gap, about a 3-foot gap between the two skins of the walls. In those gaps, grain... tons and tons of grain was stored and warmed and sweated and kept in perfect conditions until over the winter time, and then it was planted. So they were like survival centers, circular megastructures that served as places of residence of the chiefs, if you like, the rulers of society, but also the living, breathing storage units that maintained and saved the grain storage, because without grain, there was no next generation. Everything depended on agriculture and maintenance of seed through the bad months.
Interesting. Now, has Ian or anyone associated with his work found any grave sites so we can get a sense of who these people are and what
yes,
they look
indeed.
Like?
Yes, indeed. Ian has personally recovered the bones of people from, you know, built into the walls around the doorways. And in our documentary feature, he explains that these people worshipped, you know, a cult of the dead. You know, it really was a case of worshipping the bones of your ancestors, because that's where the agricultural and the fishing and survival knowledge came from. And there was an integration with afterlife, for life and the present day, which is seen in, you know, as I say, keeping the bones of the ancestors alive and actually building them into the wall of your structure. They were deemed as that important that they were placed in behind stones above the doorways. And there's been skulls found. There's been several skeletons recovered in the Bronx. And what we know of these people, you know, there's three theories as to where these people came from, two predominant theories. One is that there was an exodus of people from the northeast coast of England about 500 BC to the agricultural lands of the north. But then another theory holds that they possibly came in from the west coast, from the Western Isles known as the Hebrides. So nobody's exactly sure who these people were. The greatest belief, as I explained earlier, was that they originated from the Grúvdúr people and they were always indigenous to Caithness. But what happened? The trouble is, these buildings just appear. There's nothing before them or after. You know, there's no sort of progression of engineering or architectural style. Like, here's a 1 meter high, 1 meter wide broch. Here's a 2 meter one, and here's an 18 meter one. They just appear, and there's 200 of these things in Caithness. You know, and there's like that's under 800 miles square. 200 of these brochs, defensive living structures just crumbling into the peat and the mosslands up there in Caithness. But as I say, Ian McLean, a history champion in Caithness, is leading what's called the Caithness Broch Project, which aims to rebuild an Iron Age broch and create a vast new tourist feature in Caithness over the coming years. So it's a really educational hands-on project that's going to involve hundreds of people relearning the craft skills of Iron Age people. There's no better way to learn about how people lived in the past than to do what they did, to walk the fields they walked and to build with the stones they built.
Excellent. Ash, as always, great work. Great to have you as a member of the team. And we will talk to you again in the next week or so.
Great stuff. We'll look forward to speaking to you soon, Cliff.
Now, you can hear Ashley on a regular basis if you go to ancientorigins.net. He does a weekly program with them. But more to the point, his articles are usually fairly well available on his website. Go to ashleycowie.com. We also have a number of his articles on the Earth Ancients Facebook page, so check it out, ashleycowie.com.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Vital Transport is the tour company for Earth Ancients, and this month and up until June, we are featuring Secrets of Guatemala, June 15th through the 24th. This is a world-class tour. It's an archaeological tour that I'll be giving, and this is an opportunity to see world-class museums. We're going to visit Copan, Antigua, Quirigua, and Tikal. The thing to remember is these tours will give you not only an opportunity to see ruined cities of the ancient Maya up close and personal. This is a working tour. When I say working, we're climbing the pyramids. We're observing up close and personal a lot of the artifacts throughout the museums and up close at the various ruins. And as a special added attraction, we're going to be climbing the World Pyramid at Tikal, which has been reported to actually be a generator. Now, we know that the author and the research scientist John Burke tested this pyramid and discovered that it actually is a generator. It actually generates energy, as does many other Mayan ruins. So June 15th through the 24th, 2018, come on with me. We have just a small group that's going to go. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. Hey, give yourself a gift. Michael Lindquist, the president of Vital Transport, has really put together a real great tour. Come out and join me, and let's tour ancient Mayan ruins. To get more information, again, it's earthancients.com/tours. As the year comes to an end, I wanted to check in with Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods and Magicians of the Gods and numerous other books, to really hear what he has to say about some of the new discoveries in 2017 and his continual research on ancient unknown civilizations around the world. Here's our interview for today. So I thought it was important to check in with Graham Hancock. Graham's in the UK, as most of you know. Not only has this the last year been a time of travel for Graham, I've tried to connect with him a couple of different times, but I wanted to ask him a couple of important questions regarding the follow-up of his book. And hey, Graham, it's great to connect with you again.
Yeah, good to be with you, Cliff.
So I guess the first thing I want to ask you is this second book, Magicians of the Gods, published, released in the United States, it shows here, September in 2015.
It was released in hardback in 2015, and then a revised, updated paperback edition was released in 2016.
I guess I enjoyed it. I actually had to, because of my schedule, listen to it with Audible, which was fun to hear you talk. That must have been a chore to read through all that.
Oh, I enjoy recording my books. I wish they would let me record my novels as well, but because I can't do characters and voices, I'm confined to reading my nonfiction.
Yeah, that would be a little bit of work to bring up the characters. But I think the most important point I would like to ask you is, did you receive the reception that you thought you would get? I mean, Fingerprints of the Gods just set the standard. And you really, had to climb a big mountain to get to a level of that book. That book's just, it's like a reference for so many people. How did you feel about the reception you received with Magicians of the Gods?
I think I had a fantastic reception for Magicians of the Gods. I'm very, very pleased with the way that this book was received all over the world. As a matter of fact, it's obviously it's taking the story on a long way from Fingerprints of the Gods, and it's probably more grounded in science and in the latest research than Fingerprints of the Gods was. But it's very much a continuation of the journey on the same quest, which is, have we lost a whole episode from human history? Is there a forgotten civilization, a lost civilization lurking somewhere back there? And this is not a matter that's going to be settled with one book or even in one decade. This is a matter that has serious implications and is going to require a great deal of work before it's settled. And I'm very happy with Magicians of the Gods as a further contribution to that inquiry and that adventure.
If you were to choose a subject matter that was covered in the book, or perhaps something that was not covered, that continues this thought process or the storyline, what would you have added something in retrospect?
Well, no. My policy is to write new books rather than to add to old books. And one of the things that researching Magicians of the Gods showed me is how little time I've actually spent looking at the mysteries of North America. And that's why North America will be the focus of my next book, the book that I'm researching and writing at the moment. I'd rather do a whole new book on this explosive subject at the moment rather than go back and sort of add some chapters to an earlier book.
Right. Now, I've kind of followed your journey throughout the United States simply because I talk to people like Gary David and some of the other authors that I'm connected with. You're doing a tremendous amount of research in North America. Is that because of this asteroid hit and how it was scattered and the implications?
There's a whole range of issues behind this. It really became clear to me while I was finishing Magicians of the Gods that there was a whole new book to write, which would be very much focused on North America. And I've spent 2017 on a series of really massive research trips across North America. You know, for previous books, I've traveled very widely in South America, mm-hmm. in Mexico, in Central America, but not really very much in North America. And one of the issues that came up about North America while I was researching Magicians of the Gods, and which I reported on in Magicians of the Gods, was the evidence for a gigantic cataclysm, the epicenter of which was focused upon North America, that occurred approximately 12,800 years ago at the beginning of a mysterious geological epoch called the Younger Dryas. This has been the subject of a scientific controversy for more than a decade now. But the evidence is mounting, and I present a good chunk of that evidence in Magicians of the Gods. Mm-hmm. The evidence is mounting that the Earth was hit by at least four fragments of a disintegrated massive comet 12,860 years ago, and that this the epicenter of this cataclysm was in North America. Now, really, when you consider an extinction level event occurring in North America, accompanied by gigantic flooding and huge earth changes, and that this happened 12,800 or 12,900 years ago, you begin to realize why there are such discontinuities in North American history. This was an event that turned us all into a species with amnesia. A phrase that I've used many times since I first used it in Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995. But that amnesia was focused on North America. It's as though the memory banks of North America were wiped clean by this massive cataclysm that occurred 12,860 or so years ago. So this is the role of cataclysms and of a giant geological event in the human story is something that I think has been underrepresented by scholarship in the past, and it's something that I intend to focus on heavily in the new book. But then there's the whole issue of the wondrous, extraordinary Native American civilization that lived light on the land for tens of thousands of years, that lived in harmony with the environment, which went through that cataclysm, but then went through a later cataclysm with the arrival of Europeans in North America in the 15th century, and the beginning of the true cataclysm that we can rightly call the genocide of the Native American peoples that was perpetrated by Europeans, and that served further to wipe the memory banks of North America, leaving us with a region of just gigantic mystery where so much remains to be discovered. And I'm just fascinated by this mystery, and that's why I'm exploring it in a new book.
In your research on this, I'm just going to call it a terminating event, would you say the effects were not only felt in the North American region, but throughout the world? I mean, you speak a great deal about Göbekli Tepe and Magicians of the Gods. Would you say that this effect was global?
What happened at the beginning of the Younger Dryas 12,860 years ago was absolutely a global cataclysm. On a scale that may be compared with the so-called KT event that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, we're talking about an event on a similar scale. It really covers a vast area of the Earth's surface. We can say that the epicenter was in North America, and remember that North America 12,900 years ago, half of North America was covered with a massive ice cap, and that ice cap was up to 2 miles deep. And the evidence is that the primary impacts were on that North American ice cap. But you can draw out a map of this cataclysm, and there were impacts as far east as Syria, as a matter of fact. So what we're looking at is a comet swarm, a swarm of debris, which this debris consists of fragments of what was once a huge comet that broke up into multiple parts, a swarm of comet debris entering the Earth's atmosphere 12,860 years ago on a roughly northwest to southeast trajectory. The primary impact with objects as much as 1 kilometer in diameter being on the North American ice cap itself, but with further impacts of perhaps smaller objects on the Northern European ice cap, and the furthest east that the fallout has been traced is a site called Abu Huraira in Syria, which is extremely close to Göbekli Tepe. So we have to ask ourselves whether the megalithic constructions of Turkey, whether the mysterious underground cities of Turkey, for example, may have had something to do with this cataclysm, because this is not something that, that simply happened in a single year. We're looking at an episode decades of bombardment taking place. This is the transaction of the Earth with the torrid meteor stream tends to occur with the filaments of the torrid meteor stream that are full of dangerous objects tends to occur over periods of 10 or 20 years and then declines and goes down for thousands of years and then comes back up again. So we are still in a relationship with the torrid meteor stream today. It was objects from the torrid meteor stream that caused the beginning of the Younger Dryas cataclysm 12,860 years ago. There's now evidence in a recently published paper from the same team that there were prior impacts going back 10 or 20,000 years before that, and that there have been subsequent impacts. So we're looking at a hidden hand in human history, which is gradually revealing itself.
Hmm. When you say a terminating event, what would you give the number percentage-wise in terms of loss of human life? Would you say there was a remaining 10%, 20%? I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, because we don't have...
What we know is that exactly the same time, there were very large-scale animal extinctions. These are the extinctions of the megafauna,
the
rhinos, the mammoths, the mastodons, and so on. And there's an extreme peak concentration of these megafaunal extinctions with the period from 12,860 down to 11,600 years ago, which is the period that geologists call the Younger Dryas. It's long been a mysterious period in Earth history. We've never really had an explanation for why the Earth was coming out of the Ice Age 12,900 years ago and then suddenly plunged back into intense freezing conditions that lasted for 1,200 years. The comet impact hypothesis, which is now supported by just reams and masses of evidence in all of the leading scientific journals, is the hypothesis that best explains the cataclysm of the Younger Dryas. So we see during the Younger Dryas a massive die-off of animal species, and it would be absurd to propose that human beings escaped that cataclysm unscathed. There is evidence of disruption and disturbance of human populations at that time, but honestly, the work is really just beginning.
Yeah. You also highlight the work of Randall Carlson. We've had Randall on the show a number of times.
Randall is a good friend of mine, and he and I have done travels and adventures together. And it was traveling with Randall across the channeled scablands of the Pacific Northwest back in 2014. It was a very important research journey for me in the preparation for writing Magicians of the Gods.
Yeah, I mean, his description of these mega floods is just mind-blowing. In fact, the Mexican Geographical Society has now reported that up to as recent as 1,500 years ago, there were tsunamis and flooding in northern Mexico, and there's great evidence of that, and they don't know how that occurred. So it's really brought up a whole new level of thinking.
Well, you know, I think the science, archaeological science in particular, if archaeology can be called a science at all, has a lot more work to do on the issue of cataclysms. So you can understand how this happened, how archaeology became allergic to cataclysms. It happened when archaeology was taking shape as a discipline in the 19th century. This was also the time of Darwin's work on evolution and the time when modern science began to define itself as something that was completely separated from and unconnected to, for example, biblical ideas and biblical superstitions. And one of the strong ideas, biblical ideas, is the notion of the Great Flood, that there was a cataclysmic flood that wiped out almost all species, leaving only a few survivors. And geologists and their archaeological colleagues in the 19th and early 20th century were very keen to distance themselves from such ideas. They did not want to be involved in cataclysms, particularly of the nature of Noah's flood, in any way. They wanted to show how scientific they were, how objective they were, how they had separated themselves off from these so-called primitive superstitions. But I think in the process, they threw out the baby with the bathwater. Of course, cataclysms have played a huge role in the human story. And really today, we're only just now beginning to realize how dramatic and how massive that role has been. And certainly in the case of the event of 12,860 years ago, we are looking at an event that changed the world completely.
I have seen evidence of advanced machinery in Mexican museums that would never be allowed in United States museums. And I have this feeling that this previous civilization prior to this catastrophic event, they were fairly sophisticated. Now, I don't think that they were perhaps had the same sciences. I mean, there's rumors, there's, you know, if you want to get into the channeled material of Casey and stuff like that, which I don't think we need to. But I think there's evidence of some form of sophistication. And I'd like to ask you what you think are the possibilities of a pre-Diluvian society of high-tech individuals.
Well, the first thing I think we need to stop doing in this quest for the truth about our past, the very first thing we need to stop doing is we need to stop looking for ourselves in the past. Mm-hmm. This is a mistake that is made again and again, both by mainstream archaeologists and by the alternative side, that we somehow define an advanced civilization as us, and we look for that in the past when we look for a lost advanced civilization. And what I'm suggesting is that that is a mistake, that it's possible to have a lost advanced civilization that did not do things the way we do them. Mm-hmm. That had entirely different ways of manipulating matter, that did not rely upon perhaps mechanical advantage in the way that we do, but relied perhaps more upon latent faculties of the human mind. I think that we're looking for ourselves in the past is not the way to go. We have to consider the possibility that the civilizations, the great civilizations of the past, were extremely different from ours, and used technologies that we might not even recognize as technology, understanding the natural properties of rock, dealing with sound, with electromagnetism, and so on and so forth. We might not even recognize these as technologies. So we need to open our eyes to this wider possibility. But yes, I think the evidence is compelling that there was, let us call it an advanced civilization, in remote prehistory, but often advanced in very different ways from our own. Where we find similarities is, for example, in map making. The fact that maps have survived, that maps have come down to us, copies of copies of copies of ancient source maps now lost, which show the world with great accuracy as it looked during the last ice age more than 13,000 years ago. The fact that such maps exist tell us that somebody more than 13,000 years ago had the technology to explore and measure the planet and to lay out a longitude and latitude grid with levels of accuracy that we ourselves could not achieve until the 19th century. So the maps alone tell us that we are dealing with an ancient seafaring advanced civilization. The presence of complex geometry in monuments like the Great Pyramid, or for example, in the mound builder culture of North America, these complex geometries, which recede back deep into prehistory, are again the work of a highly intelligent, evolved, advanced civilization, by any definition.
Yeah, I mean, I was just—we just had Chris Dunn back on the show last week. Haven't spoken to him in about a year, and there's a lot going on in Giza, as you know. There's a new discovery of this chamber that he is very curious about.
This void within the Great Pyramid above the Grand Gallery.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Quite fascinating the way that Egyptologists reacted to that.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you, Graham, is that the consortium of scientists, the Japanese and the French team that's there, have now announced that they are and have built a robot that is going to be introduced into this chamber, and it's going to actually have a blimp apparatus where they inflate it, they float it into this room.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you feel could be in that room? I asked Chris. He's kind of very cards to the chest, not really wanting to divulge anything. But if you were to speculate on a chamber, which is apparently about 100 feet long, which is pretty sizable, what would you think?
It appears to lie directly above the existing Grand Gallery.
Right.
And the existing Grand Gallery is itself a stunning archaeological feature, which is 128 feet long and about 30 feet high. The Corbel Vault that leads you up into the heart of the Great Pyramid leads you into the antechamber and then into the King's Chamber itself. The muon sensing equipment has shown a similar cavity separated by a layer of building rock, and then a similar cavity, a similar sized cavity to the Grand Gallery above the Grand Gallery, running in parallel to it. And I mean, this raises the possibility that has always been there in the minds of anybody who's really got to know the Great Pyramid well, that there may be just an incredible amount of unrevealed material within the Great Pyramid. There might be an entire separate passageway, corridor, and chamber system within the Great Pyramid that has never been found yet. Mm-hmm. And indeed, traditions go back into deep antiquity of great secrets, great knowledge being concealed at Giza. And I think ultimately that's what we're going to find there. The pyramids already speak a language of mathematics, geometry, and astronomy that is highly sophisticated, and I think it's clear that what we're going to find is that the monument is much more complicated inside than we have previously believed it to be. But what that will ultimately lead to is anybody's guess, and I think it would be foolish to speculate wildly at the moment.
Why are the Egyptian antiquities authorities frowning on this research? And they must, this consortium of scientists must have paid a good fee to be able to do what they're doing. And the people like Hawass and Mark Lerner are not happy. And I guess they feel it's a waste of time, which I find quite interesting that they would even consider.
I've never understood that attitude amongst Egyptologists like Mark Lerner and Zahi Hawass. Yes, I mean they want to avoid wasting time on foolish and ill thought out ideas. But this is not a foolish and ill thought out idea. This is a scientific scan of the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, showing a giant and previously unknown cavity within it. To not be curious about that, to write it off as a matter of no significance, as Zahi Hawass did, is, to my mind, extremely bizarre.
Yeah.
Indeed, very hard to explain. I'm not sure what Egyptologists think their task is. Is their task simply to codify and document and file away the conclusions of previous Egyptologists? Or is it to be open to new discoveries and new findings, which new technology is making possible? I was really stunned, but not surprised, by the lackluster response of Egyptologists to this. But at the end of the day, you know, we need to not talk about it. Action needs to be taken. Something needs to be done. That cavity needs to be explored and investigated. And we'll see whether the Egyptian authorities allow that or not.
Yeah, I guess they have final approval on what's released or what's not, which...
They have final approval on virtually everything, including who works there and how much work they're able to do there in the future. So every archaeologist finds it in their interest to get along with the powers that be in the Egyptian government. Yeah. And they, you know, they may have interests that are not entirely to do with benefiting human knowledge.
Which I find is just mind-blowing. In May, Joe Rogan invited you and Randall to come to the studios in L.A. and debate Michael Shermer, who is the publisher of Skeptic magazine. And I think it went off fairly well, but I have to ask you, why did you agree to do that? I mean, I felt parts of it, I was uncomfortable, not only for you, but this guy obviously didn't have a clue about your research. I mean, he touched just very surface topics.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I feel it's very important that we on the alternative side of the history debate be willing to engage in face-to-face confrontations with our critics in the mainstream. I think it's important to do that. I felt that the debate with Michael Shermer was well worth doing. You know, in the alternative community, we spend a lot of time talking to one another, if you like, you know, preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
And it's important that we extend beyond that, and that we challenge ideas in the mainstream, and that we be willing to engage with and debate with mainstream figures like Michael Shermer. I'm all for skepticism. I just think that perhaps skeptics should be skeptical about the existing knowledge base as well as about the alternative knowledge base. Skepticism all too often is a disguise for ideological defense of the intellectual status quo.
Yeah.
I felt it was important to challenge that. So I'm glad that I did that debate, and I think it put before the public a number of issues that might not have been made clear before. And the only thing I regret is I lost my temper and got angry. I've been putting up with the extremely unpleasant ad hominem attacks from so-called skeptics for more than a quarter of a century.
And yeah, it probably built up, and you're like, I've had enough of this.
It kind of built up, but you know, that's my truth, and that's what I did. I sat there on that show and said it the way I think it is.
I mean, yeah.
And it seems to, you know, I think it has generated further debate and further discussion in this field. So I do think it was worth doing, but it wasn't a pleasant experience. It's never pleasant to sit down and have a really, you know, intense argument with somebody who absolutely hates your work. But I did my best.
Yeah, I mean, he represents the status quo of academia. But the thing is, he really, I think, in one portion of the, I want to say confrontation, but it was debate.
It wasn't that confrontation.
He didn't even know about Göbekli Tepe, I believe, right?
I think he knew about it. The person who didn't know about Göbekli Tepe is another mainstream figure I've debated, and that's Zahi Hawass,
who we were talking about
a moment ago in connection with the pyramids. It turned out, at least on his own admission, that Zahi Hawass didn't even know anything about Göbekli Tepe, which is astonishing, really. Göbekli Tepe is probably the single most important archaeological site in the world, and for the world's most famous Egyptologist to say now, you know, he just concentrates on Egypt and doesn't think about Turkey, isn't good enough.
it's just not good enough, particularly since Göbekli Tepe touches very specifically on an issue that Hawass has been involved in, which is the issue of the age of the Great Sphinx of Giza. The argument of mainstream archaeologists has always been that how could a lost civilization have been responsible for building the Great Sphinx? If there was a civilization more than 12,000 years ago, you know, there would have been other monuments of similar age, other megalithic monuments of similar age, and there aren't. Well, Egyptologists could say that in 1992, but they absolutely can't say it today now that Göbekli Tepe has been discovered. Göbekli Tepe is even quite close to the Sphinx. You know, it's in the same general neighborhood, and Göbekli Tepe is a 12,000-year-old site. And I would say that if you can make Göbekli Tepe, then you can make the Great Sphinx. And therefore, it was very surprising to find that Zahi Hawass was completely ignorant on the subject of Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah. Well, and that was I think you tried. Was that this year that you tried to debate with him somewhere in Europe? And he got upset because you were associated with Robert Bouval.
Well, no, the story of the Zahi Hawass debate. if anybody goes to my website and goes to the articles page and just search my name, you'll come across a link to this soon enough. But the story of the Zahi Hawass debate was that it had been trailered for more than a year before it happened. I believe it was in April of 2015 that it actually took place. And Zahi fully understood that he was there to present the orthodox point of view while I would be presenting the alternative point of view. And in presenting the alternative point of view, I could not neglect to report on the work of some of my colleagues, groundbreaking work such as Robert Bouval's Orion correlation. And it so happened that what happened was that I was going to speak first, and then Zahi would speak after me, and then we would have our debate. And I was actually in the conference hall setting up my slides prior to giving my presentation, and there were only a few members of the audience present, but fortunately one of them had a mobile phone with him. And while I was testing my slides, I showed a slide of Robert Bouval and the Orion correlation. And this immediately caused Zahi Hawass to go completely berserk.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I think maybe he and Robert have some kind of past life issue between them or something. They need to work out, because the antipathy on Zahi's side towards Robert was just crazy. And yeah. he went berserk, and he said if I was going to talk about Bouval, he would refuse to debate. He was going to walk out. And indeed, he did walk out. And then he sat outside the conference hall and sulked for an hour and a half while I gave my presentation. And then he came back in and gave his presentation. And it was after that that he was asked by a member of the audience about Göbekli Tepe and revealed his woeful ignorance on the subject.
Well, I mean, there are a number.
These clips are all over the internet.
Yeah.
And they're on my website.
There's a YouTube, classic YouTube of him actually screaming in the room. And people, in fact, his assistants trying to calm him down, and you're trying to help him with the logic of the debate or whatever, and he's just kind of losing it. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to see that and to realize that this was the person who held the keys to the Giza Plateau for so many decades. And who could make, you know, fundamental decisions on what kind of archaeology was done there, or indeed whether any archaeology was done there at all.
Do you think that it's possible that he's kind of keeping some sophistication of the Giza Plateau under wraps? Do you think that he knows more than he reveals?
Well, your question is it possible that he knows more than he reveals? And the answer to that question is yes, it's certainly possible that he knows more than he reveals. Whether he actually does know more than he reveals since I'm not telepathic, is not something that I can I'm equipped to make a judgment on.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that over the years, his involvement with the Sphinx and with interesting drilling projects around the Sphinx, he has been involved in a drilling project around the Sphinx, supposedly to clear away
surface water, groundwater from around the Sphinx. But, you know, there are strong suggestions of a hidden chamber beneath the Sphinx. Who knows really what's been going on? So this is part of the problem with Giza and with archaeology, is that there's too much secrecy, too much exclusivity, too much focus on, you know, we are on the so-called experts who believe that they know everything, and a deep unwillingness to consider any alternative ideas, which might bring something refreshing and new to the table.
Yeah. Yeah, I find him very suspicious, simply because his attitude is this kind of like, this is the way it is, and I've told you, and I'm the expert, and this is what you should believe, rather than any other consideration.
Exactly, exactly. That's the way it works, and it's in a sense. It is true of the whole discipline of Egyptology, certainly of the previous generation of Egyptologists, that they regarded themselves as these, these sort of almost mythical experts whose word could not be challenged in any way, whose pronouncements upon ancient Egypt were immediately to be taken as fact rather than as opinions. But I do think that it's changing. I think that the younger generation of Egyptologists, those who've been exposed to the storm of ideas over the last quarter of a century, are more open-minded. And generally, as I travel around the world, I'm finding that the younger generation of archaeologists are much more open to exploring extraordinary ideas about the past than the previous generation was.
Yeah, I think you're right. As the year comes to a close, what discoveries which were revealed this year support your hypothesis of an advanced civilization prior to this Younger Dryas period?
I think it's not so much a matter of specific discoveries that have taken place in 2017. It's a matter of broad trends and changes in science. For example, North America, until really quite recently, was believed to have been completely uninhabited by human beings until about 13,000 years ago. This was the so-called Clovis First View of the peopling of the Americas. It's called Clovis First because it's named after a type site near the town of Clovis, New Mexico. And that type site is called Blackwater Draw. And there were found the evidence of mammoth hunting and a very sophisticated spear points and arrowheads, which are called fluted points. Very distinctive technological culture of these people. And for really from the 1920s, when Blackwater Draw was discovered, right through until actually it's still going on in a way, although it's receding, the view of mainstream archaeology was that the Clovis people were the first people, the first human beings ever to enter the Americas. And the model was called Clovis First. And any archaeologist who challenged that model with evidence of a site that was older than 13,000 years ago, and my goodness, there are dozens of such sites in North America, Central America, and South America, but any archaeologist who challenged the Clovis First paradigm would immediately be subject to ostracism and attack by his colleagues. A classic example is Jacques Cinq-Mars, who excavated the Bluefish Caves in the Yukon in Canada. Mm-hmm. He had all his research grants withdrawn. He was completely marginalized and ostracized by his colleagues. They would actually stand up and walk out of his presentations at conferences because he was arguing that there had been human beings in the Yukon 24,000 years ago. He went through a shitstorm of insults and attacks by his colleagues. But you know what? It turned out he was 100% right. The latest scientific investigations have absolutely proved that he was correct. And now we're looking at a situation where until 2007 or 2008, and there are still a few academics clinging on by the skin of their teeth to the Clovis First model, we're looking at a situation where for 50 years it was said that there were no human beings in the Americas before 13,000 years ago. And now suddenly we have the floodgates unleashed as the Clovis First model has fallen. And it's not just a matter of Bluefish Caves 24,000 years ago or Topper
in South Carolina 50 to 60,000 years ago. It's also the case of the Cerruti mastodon find in San Diego in Southern California, where we have evidence of human presence in North America 130,000 years ago.
Yes.
That is 10 times as old as the Clovis culture. Now, archaeologists have been telling us for 50 years that nothing happened involving human beings in America until 13,000 years ago. And now we have this just flood of new evidence that proves that a huge amount of stuff was happening in North America between 130,000 years ago and 13,000 years ago. So this new information on the peopling of the Americas, this complete overthrow of an existing paradigm, it very strongly supports the notion of that we are a species with amnesia and that we're missing an important part of our story. And because of the evidence of cataclysm, I believe that the heart of that important missing piece is going to turn out to be in North America. Other intriguing discoveries, not just in 2017, but over the last few years, again, concern this issue of human origins. You know, we had the idea that here we are, we're anatomically modern humans. And then we know it's been accepted that our ancestors interbred with Neanderthals, and that we have 1 to 2 to 3, perhaps in some cases 4% of Neanderthal DNA in the modern human genome. But then we've discovered that there were other human species, human enough for us to interbreed with them, which existed in the world at the same time as Neanderthals. For example, the Denisovans. I made a trip to Siberia in September to visit Denisova Cave, where the remains of a human being, not anatomically modern, but who left their DNA in the modern human genome have been found. And interestingly, in the Denisovan lair of Denisova Cave in southern Siberia, really extraordinary artifacts have been found. A beautiful bracelet that had been drilled through by some kind of device that drilled at incredibly high speed, and very high precision needles, and so on and so forth. So we're looking at a very mysterious episode in human culture. And it turns out that this Denisovan DNA is present in the Americas, but almost exclusively amongst certain tribes in the Amazon jungle in South America. And they turn out to be closely related to groups that live in Melanesia and indeed even to Australian Aborigines. So the question is, how did they get their DNA to South America without leaving any trace in North America? Because the previous model has always been that all our ancestors came across the Bering Straits when it was a land bridge, when sea level was lower. It was called Beringia, that they came across the Bering Straits by land and they entered North America on foot. This new DNA evidence now means we must contemplate the possibility that the peopling of the Americas involved oceanic journeys, perhaps right the way across the Pacific Ocean, and again, evidence there for a much higher level of culture than we have previously reckoned with.
So if you were to paint a picture of this pre-catastrophic event, would it run something like this? We have a society of sophisticated human beings on the Earth. This event happens, basically wipes the planet clean, and I'm just going to throw out a number. 20% of humanity is left. The Denisovans come around. They are survivors.
Can I just stop you right there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because we're looking at a disaster that affected the climate of the entire Earth.
Right.
So the comet impact itself, or rather the impact of multiple fragments of this disintegrated giant comet, would in themselves have caused a massive die-off of animal species and of human beings. But then you have 1,200 years of intense cold. You know, the freezing meltwater pouring off the North American ice cap that was unleashed by the heat of these comet impacts poured into the North Atlantic Ocean and stopped the Gulf Stream dead in its tracks. The Gulf Stream is part of the global meridional overturning circulation of our planet. It's the central heating system of our planet. And that central heating system was switched off by the comet impacts 12,860 years ago. So you then have 1,200 years of freezing temperatures, very arid, very dry, which is very difficult for things to grow. So it's not just the disaster itself, but it's the follow-up to the disaster that leads to this massive die-off. Okay. And the resetting, in my view, of the human story, that's when we lose a whole civilization from our memory and remember it now only in myths and traditions that are astonishingly similar from all around the world.
Okay, right. Okay, so that makes sense. So we have the reboot, places like Göbekli Tepe, which is kind of a university. We don't know really what was presented there.
So that's how I see Göbekli Tepe. I see it as a place where a transfer of technology was attempted, where the survivors of a lost civilization who already fully understood everything that needed to be known about megalithic architecture, and my goodness, Göbekli Tepe is the ultimate megalithic site, and who already understood everything about agriculture, that they brought these ideas to Turkey and that they set up Göbekli Tepe as a center of innovation out of which these ideas could then be manifested and taught and exchanged.
Okay.
They need a project. I think that when you look at notions of transfer of technology, if you consider seriously the possibility that survivors were left over from a higher level, more advanced, more sophisticated civilization, their survival strategy would be to settle down amongst other peoples who lived on the Earth at that time. When I speak of a lost civilization of the Ice Age, I'm not saying that everybody on Earth was a highly advanced member of a highly advanced civilization. I'm suggesting that during the Ice Age, the world was very much like it is today, that there were hunter-gatherers in that world, and there were also members of an advanced civilization. So we today call ourselves the members of an advanced civilization, but we coexist with hunter-gatherers in the Sahara Desert, in the Namibian deserts, and in the Amazon jungle, for example. And if a cataclysm were to strike our world today, it would not primarily be the urban dwellers of advanced civilization who survived it, because very few of us have any survival skills. We all depend on a complicated, interrelated network of assistance that society at large provides. The people who would survive such a cataclysm today would be the hunter-gatherers, the meek of the earth, the simple, humble people who live close to the earth. And if any of us survived, we would take refuge amongst them. Now, we then might have ideas that we could share with them. We might well wish to transfer technology to them. And in order to do that, the best way to do that would be to set up a giant, large-scale project like Göbekli Tepe or like the Giza Plateau and set people to work on it. And while setting them to work on it, pass on ideas to them that they had not considered before.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of a reboot and, I mean, because what happens, you can just imagine if a disaster happened today, all our technology is turned off. We would de-evolve. It would be, you know, horrible.
I think our civilization, we fancy ourselves as being this very strong, almost impregnable civilization that nothing can touch, and nothing could be further from the truth. We are a very fragile civilization, and we are very easily broken. And that's because of one of the great strengths of our civilization, which is specialization, that people specialize in particular areas. It's a great strength of our civilization, but it means that nobody has the whole suite of skills necessary to move civilization forward. That's the problem with this material, we lose memory, we lose skills.
Do you think the Hindus have it correct with the yugas, that humans have cycled for millions of years of start and then destruction and then rebirth and then development and then all over again destruction?
I'm not sure if it's millions of years. The evidence for a last common ancestor with the chimpanzees 6.5 million years ago is pretty sound, in my opinion. But what's becoming clear is that, first of all, there were more than one species of human beings on the planet. There were anatomically modern human beings. There were Neanderthals. There were Denisovans. And we were all close enough at a genetic level to interbreed. And to exchange genes and to pass those down into the modern world. Sorry, I just lost the point of your question. Remind me of it.
If the yugas are valid, the yuga system.
What's intriguing is that the yuga system does visualize this cyclic process in the universe, whereby civilizations and the consciousness of human beings rise and fall. And I would say there's a lot of evidence for that. That's a very true observation of the past of humanity. That we go through cyclic rises and falls. That civilization can rise to a very high level and then fall away and be almost completely lost. Just as our civilization could be almost completely lost in the event of a massive global cataclysm. The other aspect of the evidence that's intriguing is that the evidence for anatomically modern humans keeps on getting pushed back. It used to be said that it was 200,000 years ago, the oldest anatomically modern human skeletal remains. Well, now that's been pushed back to nearly 400,000 years ago.
Right.
And I suspect it's going to be pushed back further and further and further.
Wow. Hey, we're down at our time. I have one final question, and this is one that I find intriguing simply because you've debated a number of authors on the subject of aliens' interaction with humans. I will say, though, that both Robert Bivol and Chandra Wickramsey's have a new book called The Cosmic Womb that basically identifies the beginnings of Earth life as off-world specimens. What is your feeling about...
First of all, I do highly recommend the new book by Robert and Chandra.
Oh, you had a chance to read it then?
Oh, yes, yes. It's okay, it's a very good book. I've known Robert, of course, for many years, and I've known Chandra Wickramasinghe for many years as well. And Chandra has for a long time been a proponent of the notion of panspermia.
Panspermia, yes.
Which is that the seeds of life, perhaps in the form of bacteria, are carried across the universe on comets. And when those comets hit a planet, they spill out their cargo of bacteria. And if the circumstances are right, those bacteria will start to evolve. And the suggestion is that that's what happened on the early Earth 3.9 billion years ago, and that 3.9 billion years later, here we are, the result of that that evolution. And there's another version of the same idea, which was put forward by Chandra Wickramasinghe's colleague, Sir Fred Hoyle, and also by Francis Crick, which is called directed panspermia, which suggests that the seeds of life were deliberately sent out across the universe by an alien civilization in a galaxy far, far away. And I would emphasize that is the Nobel Prize winner, Francis Crick, who put that idea forward in his 1981 book, Life Itself.
Right.
That's not just me spouting off.
But do you believe at any level, at any time of our history, that there has been direct intervention with Earth humans or Earth human hominins by off-world beings?
I'm perfectly open to that idea. I don't see compelling evidence for it at the moment. Okay. Those of us who are trying to get history rewritten need to present strong and well-founded arguments.
I agree.
I do not feel that the arguments for ancient astronauts being involved in the construction of the pyramids or anything such are strong. I think those are weak arguments, and I think they weaken the entire alternative cause. We need to focus on strong evidence if we're going to win this argument.
Excellent. Graham,
I've said this many times. I just don't feel I need aliens to explain the mysteries of the human past. I think they're better, more simply, more elegantly, more parsimoniously explained by the notion of a lost advanced human civilization of prehistoric antiquity.
Yeah. By the way, your introduction and work on the Gaia series, Ancient Civilizations, was excellent. I enjoyed that whole program. They're one of our sponsors here at Earth Ancients. And
good. I haven't had a chance to see that yet. I must try and find some time and watch it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, they did a great job. It was very well presented. And I hope that you can do another season of it, because it seems like it was – I think it was seven to ten series on that theme, Ancient Civilizations.
Right.
Yeah. Very, very well done. Graham, it's been a pleasure, as always, and much continued success in the new year. And when is this new book scheduled to be released?
Well, I'll be delivering it to the publishers in the summer of 2018, so late 2018 or early 2019.
All right. Can't wait. All right. Thank you, Graham. Have a great holiday.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you. Have a great holiday season.
Okay, that's it for today's program. I hope you enjoyed it. It's always fun to talk to Graham. We have one more show next week that ends the year, September 30th. Merry Christmas!
I'm dreaming of a white just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry.
Christmas card.